Chapter 25. War is coming. Leia sits and tries not to think about it. She doesn't turn on the holonet. She doesn't go to her balcony on Chandrilla and look up in the sky to see the fleet gathering in orbit. Instead, she sits on a chair in the room that will very soon serve as the nursery to her son. The cradle sits nearby. Next to it is the sanctuary tree, the one given to her by the little Ewok, Wicket. She's never been able to feel the tree, the so-called serpent's puzzle with the Force, but she can see with her eyes that the burnished golden bark shines with health, and every day the twining branches sport new scarlet leaves. But her baby boy, him, she can effortlessly feel inside her. Not just the way that all mothers can feel the living creature within, but she can feel him with the invisible hands of the Force. With it, she senses the margins of his burgeoning mind. She knows his mood. She can tell that he's healthy. He is less a human-shaped thing and more a pulsing, living band of light. Light that sometimes dims, that sometimes is thrust through with a vein of darkness. She tells herself that it's normal. Luke said to her, "Leia, we all have that." He explained that the brighter the light, the darker the shadow. Right now, her son is upset, tumbling inside her as if he can't get comfortable, his light flickering with the dark. She centers herself and concentrates. The walls of the room fall away. Everything is white, and then it's black. Then she's in the calm, airless void. As Leia finds her peace, so does her son. He stops turning. Then he gets the hiccups. She sighs, and it brings her out of it. But she laughs, too, because the hiccups tickle her. They're like little bubbles inside, a curious effervescence, like nothing Leia has ever felt before.
"My son is alive. The future is bright."
That bright future casts dark shadows, though. And now war is again on the horizon. Not a new war, no. The same war they've been fighting all this time. A war that began as a rebellion and soon transformed into a proper struggle between the Empire and the Republic. Now, she hopes, this will finish it. The future is bright, yes, but only if this goes well. Only if the Empire burns out in a searing flash, gone to ash. Han comes home not long after, and he finds her there in the room. He tells her only a little about what happened on Nakadia, but it's enough for her to know that he had a hand in making things right.
"That's what you're good at," she tells him, reaching up to meet him as he stoops down. "Making things right."
She kisses his cheek. He looks, aw shucks, embarrassed.
"It's happening," he says. "Jakku."
"I know."
"It's gonna be one hell of a battle. It might get bad."
"I know that, too."
He chews his lip.
"It feels weird, doesn't it?"
"Not being there, you mean?"
"Yeah. You, me, Luke, Chewie, the Falcon, those two walking, talking garbage cans. It feels weird we're not part of it."
"We've got our own adventure."
She pats her belly.
"End of an era," he says.
"And the start of a new one."
The baby turns inside her again, troubled by something she cannot feel and cannot yet understand. War is coming. And hopefully, soon after, it ends. Sinjir cares little for the vagaries of war. He tells himself he has no investment in whether the New Republic wins or loses, even as he feels himself looking forward to the demise of the Empire he once served. Rather, he needs the war
because that is the only way he fears he'll ever get to see Jazz and Nora again.
Ow, Condor says, wincing. You're not paying attention to what you're doing again.
I'm paying attention perfectly, Sinjir says, screwing a small plug of absorbent fiber cloth into Condor's nose. The slicer winces and pulls away.
Your mind is wandering like a child at a toy market.
Sinjir shrugs. Fine, yes, perhaps. Sorry. I'm more used to causing pain than soothing it.
He winds another bit of cloth into the other nostril.
The two of them are back on Chandrilla. Solo brought them home.
They toyed with staying on Nakadiya for a time, but Condor frowned at the notion, saying that the pastoral planet made Chandrilla look like Coruscant.
It's all just crops, he said at the time,
and Sinjir was inclined to agree. Now Sinjir works to mend the slicer's abused face. Back to gauze, fiber cloth, and a good old-fashioned needle and thread. The worst hit was the last one Condor took, the one they heard over the comlink.
I must commend you again, Sinjir says. A transceiver tooth? Genius. And I never knew.
That's how Condor broadcast to them, using his tongue to slowly, arduously flip to their comlink channel.
The broadcast ended when that Herglick thug whapped him in the face. A man must keep his secrets.
Not me. I have none. I am done with secrets.
Somehow I doubt that, Sin.
Condor's gentle eyes twinkle.
Sinjir admires the man. His drive, his capability. After rescuing the slicer from the warehouse, they had to move fast. The good news was, as suspected, that the Black Sun and Red Key thugs had hacked a line to the data pads of their five senators. The line was encrypted, though, which is where Condor came in. The slicer did as the name suggested, slicing through algorithms like a man with a blade cutting ribbons. In only a few minutes, Condor, beaten, woozy, caked in his own blood, stole access to the senators' data pads. And from there, they delivered the messages. Sinjir's initial idea was to threaten them, but Sinjir also knew that threats created fear, and fear made people act a certain way. It's one thing to have someone bound to a chair. There, you control the fear. You wield it like a weapon. But those senators were in the wind. A fight-or-flight response could have had them doing any number of unpredictable things, turning themselves in, running for the exits, or even voting as the syndicates demanded they vote in the hope it would save them. No. Instead, Sinjir said to make them an offer, an offer braided into the threat. He had Condor send a missive telling them they would be given pardons if they voted with the Chancellor. And further, they told Nimtar that his child was safe, and Sorka that her prized Jerba was rescued. That latter bit was a necessary lie. Sorka will soon learn that the syndicates already sold her prize animal on the butcher's black market. And with that, they did it. They solved the plot. They got the votes. The final battle is coming.
Condor says, "You're worried."
Am I that obvious?
Usually not. This time you are.
Condor clasps his hand.
Jazz and Nora will be fine.
I could go. I should go. Demand to be put in a ship. Like Jom. Like Temin. I should be there.
You're not a soldier.
I trained to be once, Sinjir says. I know how to fight.
If you want to go, I'll go too. Maybe they can use a slicer.
Sinjir nods.
I suppose it's not impossible.
He hates that he wants to be there. He knows himself, and he should be balking at this. Loyalty only goes so far. And despite once being the man who tested the loyalty of others, he himself is not particularly fond of the concept.
And yet, here he is, wanting to rush into danger again for his friends. He supposes he should stop being surprised. I've become a different person than I expected. Or maybe he was a different person all along, led to a myth about himself, created by himself. Is that how people are? Do they all have two sides? Who they really are and who they believe themselves to be? Who do we ask? Considering the size of the favor we just performed in service to the Chancellor, I think we might ask her. Condor draws a deep breath.
Are we going to Jakku? Are we really doing this?
We might be, dearest Condor. We might be.
I'd hoped for a nicer vacation.
Sinjir hmms.
You and me both.
War is coming. It's what John Burrell is built for. He never really felt like he trained for war, but rather that he was just plain made that way. All his life it's been about the fight. He fought against the Empire on Onderon. He fought against his own bloodline brothers there. He fought as a rebel. He fought as a commando for the New Republic. He fought with Nora and her crew. And now he wants to fight again. Sergeant Dalalo Dacen is, with her Spec Force team, loading munitions onto a low Atmo U-Wing. It's a fat-bellied starfighter, used as a troop transport, meant for fast, dangerous insertion into enemy territory. It's an old class of fighter, but this is an old class of soldier. Jom feels that way too. He whistles to Dacen as he skirts past one of the ship's four engines.
Sergeant,
he calls. She turns and stares down her long nose at him.
You cleaned up,
she says. And he has. He shaved everything down, though he left the handlebar mustache and the meat chop sideburns. He combed his hair, best he can do to look like a proper commando again.
What do you need, Burrell?
I need to go with you.
No can do. Not my call. You want back in? There's a whole chain of command you gotta climb.
She sees his face and offers both hands up in a peaceable gesture.
Don't get mad at me, Jom. You broke ranks and did your own thing. You go and talk to General Tybin. Maybe he gives you a stamp and gets you back on your way. But it won't be with my crew.
Damn it, Dacen.
Sergeant Dacen, if you recall.
His nostrils flare.
Sergeant, this fight, it matters. Maybe more than all the others.
She probably thinks he means it because this could be the Empire's last hurrah. And that's true. But for Jom, it's personal. For Jom, it's about Jazz. He drops his back. He cranes his neck so that the vertebrae pop.
I'll fight you for it. I'll fight the whole platoon for it. I take even one of you out, I want to take that commando's place.
Dacen laughs.
We'd kill you.
Maybe, but that's better than having to go through the bureaucracy.
Coming off the ramp, pushing an empty gravlifter, is another Spec Force commando. A goat-snouted, three-eyed Gran, by the name of Margal. Jom knows him a little. He's like Jom, good with heavy ordnance.
I hear something about a fight,
the Gran growls.
I'm in.
Cool it,
Dacen says.
Nobody's throwing fists today. And you're right about the bureaucracy. You start making noise here, I might have reports to do. And damn the stars, I hate filling out reports.
Dacen, Sergeant.
Stow it, Jom. You want in on this mission? Fine. I got an extra jump seat. You want to do your part? I'll say you came aboard and hidden ahead until we were pushing hyperspace. But after that, I won't stand for you. You come home, they might have a court-martial or a dishonor badge for you. That weight's on your shoulders. And I won't carry it.
Thanks, Sarge.
We leave in 5. Step to it, Commando. The war won't wait.
War is coming. And Temmin wants to be there.
He steps in front of Wedge and drops his hastily packed rucksack on the ground with a thud. Wedge looks at it and arches an eyebrow.
What's this?
He asks the young man.
I'm enlisting.
It doesn't work like that, Tim.
I don't care. I want to go to Jakku.
You're a boy.
Not anymore. You were training me to be with Phantom Squadron. I can fly an X-Wing.
Wedge sets down his data pad. All around him, the hangar buzzes with activity. Already, most of the starfighters and their pilots have gone on to join the fleet, massing above Chandrila, soon to fly on to Jakku. But all the same, that's just the first wave. They have to prep more fighters, more pilots, prime torpedoes, test weapons systems, get the next set of pilots ready. There's a lot to do, and he tells Temen as much.
You can fly a training simulator, kid. I've got work to do. I've piloted the Halo. I've piloted the Falcon. You even let me do a few rounds in an X-Wing. I can fight, and I will. I'll steal a ship if I have to. I'll steal a flying brick cargo loader and crash it into the front deck of a Star Destroyer. I'm going to Jakku. And I'd rather you be there with me. Phantom Squadron is shut down.
Temen steps over his sack and looks up at Wedge. The young man's eyes flare with eager fury.
Then bring it back from the dead. Nobody has to know we're doing it. Nobody has to see us coming. We can be like real phantoms, Wedge. Not heroes in the books. But who cares about being in the books?
Now tears shine in Temen's eyes.
My mom is there. My droid, too. I want them back. You don't want to help me get them? Fine. But then I'll know who you really are. And it isn't the guy who flew against 2 Death Stars and all the Empire. I'll know you're not a pilot anymore. You're just some hangar monkey. Some tired old sir yes sir game leg who cares more about docking ledgers than he does about actual people.
Now it's Wedge's turn. Anger and grief rise up inside him. The anger like fire, the grief like smoke. He wants to tell Temen how wrong he is, but he can't. Because the kid isn't wrong, is he? Again, Wedge is reminded of the Rebel Alliance, and Kashyyyk, and all the sacrifices made on behalf of the New Republic. Sometimes doing the right thing wasn't the same as following orders.
Ah, forget it,
Temen says, wiping his eyes with the back of his hands. His lip trembles.
I should have known you were out of the game.
Wait. Temen pauses in picking up his bag.
Why should I?
Meet me in Hangar 47 on the north side in 2 hours.
What's in Hangar 47?
Phantom Squadron.
War is coming. It waits out there in the black. Commodore Kirsta Augate stands on the bridge of the Concorde, the first Nadiri Mark I Starhawk commissioned for the New Republic, and not the last. 2 more Starhawks hang out there in the space above Chandrila. They wait with dozens of other capital ships. The Alderaanian Sunspire, the Corellian Redeemer, an assault frigate, and of course, their flagship, the Mon Calamari's Home One. Her hands are shaking. As they do. In the glass of the viewport, though, is a ghost hovering amid the fleet. A ghost with a ruined face. Half the face is smooth and plasticky, fitting poorly against the other, more natural half. That plastic has none of the blemishes associated with flesh. No moles, no marks, no crow's feet by the eyes, no curving lines carved around the side of the mouth. It is an imperfect fit as well. Around the eye, the skin ends prematurely, yielding the dark turning mechanics that support the mechanical eye. That eye glows red. It telescopes as the aperture opens, and it focuses on its own reflection. For the face of the Wraith is just Augate's own mask. On Liberation Day, one of the Rhodian ex-captives turned on her,
driven to the act by a control chip in the meat of his brain. He fired, and she took the hit on the side of her face. They reconstructed the bone, but the flesh was gone. What's there now is new skin, grown in a lab and applied with a brush. Over time, it is meant to look more natural, but it'll never be her own. Agate will always know. The eye had to go. She asked for a mechanical replacement. The Oculus lens that they installed at least has function, if not form. It is ugly and protrusive, and makes her feel less than human. But with it, she can see heat signatures and other data as long as she closes her other human eye.
Commodore!
Behind her, Admiral Akbar steps out of the turbolift. It shushes closed behind him. Akbar has been a friend through all of this, a comforting presence at her bedside and through all the surgeries.
I never thought I'd be back, she says.
Her voice is different since the attack. The blast took out some of her teeth, messed up her jaw. It's all been reconstructed, but now she sounds different. She hates it.
I'm glad you accepted the invitation.
She turns. The Mon Calamari approaches, his hands clasped behind his back. As he walks, she tells him,
It means a great deal to me, Admiral, but I still have reservations. I don't know that I'm ready.
You are. You must be. Commodore, you are among our best and our brightest.
Some of the light has gone out of me, Admiral.
And despite what happened, you remain one of our most vital commanders, because you recognize the burden of war. You do not go to it lightly. You do not arrive with anger, not even after the Empire struck us at home and stole your eye from you.
I gave up command of this ship.
And I have returned it to you. Lieutenant Commander Spawn is glad to serve at your behest.
I'm not ready.
Akbar's voice softens. He reaches out and places one of his webbed hands on her shoulder.
None of us are ready. No one can ever be truly ready for what war brings. The best we can do is meet it with our face forward and our hearts clear. You will do that. I know you will.
They know we're coming. They must. With an open government and a free media, that means the Holonet will have reported on the vote. And surely the Empire knows about the Oculus spying on them from afar.
Almost surely. Ensign Del Tora reports that their fleet has grown and is consolidating in a defensive arrangement. This will not be a surprise for them or for us. It is the purest form of battle. Both sides ready to fight.
It may be a ruse. They may be luring us in.
If they are, we will be ready.
She feels a single tear threaten to slip free of her one good eye, and hastily blinks it away.
Tell me we're going to win this. Tell me this will be the end of it. The end of the Empire, and the start of a new galaxy.
I'm no prophet, Kirsta. I do not know who will win this day, or who will even survive it to see the outcome. I only know it will be an honor to fight alongside you once again. Whether this is our last battle, or the first of many more to come.
His long fingers give her shoulder a squeeze. Agate struggles not to cry out. She wants to run off this bridge and go home. Get in her bed. Hide under the covers, turn out the lights, and wait for Holonet to tell her who won, who lost, who lived, who died.
When did I become this coward? Why am I quaking like a gun-shy child? May the Force be with you, is all she says.
Akbar nods.
And with you, Commodore. I must go. It is almost time.
War is coming. And soon, she prays, it is ending.